You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. Today I'm talking with Rachel Lawrence. And Rachel has been on this show before, something like 4 or 5 years ago. We have both worked together on PSI for quite some time, and that's how we know each other already for quite a long time. I've met at lots of different conferences. And Rachel works in an area that I find really fascinating, and that when I started to work as a statistician, I had honestly no clue about. So I knew that these kind of things exist, but I had no clue how you get to them, how you analyze them, what's important for them, what are different guidances. And these are patient-reported outcomes, or there's another acronym to which we will come later. So, Rachel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Great to be back.
For those who haven't listened to the first episode, maybe you can quickly introduce yourself.
Yeah, certainly. So I work at Adelphi Values in our patient-centered outcomes team. So we're a specialist consultancy company that focus on everything to do with the PROs, including the development from the interviews and the qualitative side all the way across to analysis and interpretation and all sorts of different disease areas, everything you can think of, really. So yeah, I've been with Adelphi for 8 years now, really focusing on those patient-reported outcomes, but from a statistical point of view. So I brought my previous background in pharma at AstraZeneca into this world as a statistician. So I'm really passionate about thinking about things like the estimands being really defined right for those PRO endpoints across the ground and the interface between the statistical world in the pharma side of things and all this PRO language and the way we have all those sort of questionnaire data and how they can be used and interpreted.
Let's talk a little bit about patient-reported outcomes, PROs, and what role do they play in clinical research, and how has that developed over the last years?
Patient-reported outcomes used to be a bit more periphery in the drug development side, but they really are much more recognized to be really central. They can be primary endpoints that determine drug approval and labeling, even as secondary endpoints, and they're really recognized by regulators and particularly payers as well. It's really important to understand that patient viewpoint of the outcome of treatments. And I think over since the early 2000s, those guidance documents from the FDA, EMA, payers have really increased and helped people understand a lot more what the FDA and other regulators are really looking for in terms of putting patient outcomes at the heart of all aspects of the drug development.
Yeah, it's definitely important for payers. If you, for example, look into the European JCA documentations that are heavily influenced by the German HTA documentation, so the EQUIC methods paper, you can find a lot about patient-reported outcomes there. And you can demonstrate your added medical benefit or value through these, sometimes much easier than through other clinical endpoints, especially if these are lab results or anything like that.
Yeah.
There's a new term that has developed, and this is clinical outcomes assessments. Where is that coming from, and why do we need to speak about COAs now instead of PROs?
COA is the umbrella term, if you like. And so I think it has always been there, but it's helpful because then it reflects different types of these ways of measuring the patient's experience. So there's four main COAs, if you like. So PRO that we already spoken about. So that stands for patient reported outcomes. So that would be something, a questionnaire a patient sits and fills in, that might be on their phone, of course, on a tablet, not necessarily on paper very often. And it could be measuring something like questionnaires around fatigue in Crohn's disease, for example. So you're really directly asking questions from the patient. Then we've got ones called OBSRO, so observer reported endpoints. So that it might be something like a count of an event that a caregiver can describe. So the number of seizures that somebody has experienced. So it's very relevant, but it's reported by that observation, if you like. We also have ClinROs. So they're endpoints that are reported by the clinicians. An example of that would be something like the PSAI, the PASI index in psoriasis. And that's the severity and the extent of your psoriasis. So there are quite a few elements to that, and they come together and make this confined score that the clinician is scoring about those patients. And finally, the fourth category of a COA would be a CURFRO. So this is a sort of performance-based measure. So something like measuring that might directly measure your mobility. They have been all put together to make the terms COA, and different ones are more applicable in different disease areas, maybe different things in pediatrics. And you might have a combination somewhere, sometimes, of both aspects as well. So yeah, put together.
So what is then not a COA?
There's also this sort of line in terms of digital endpoints as well and wearables. Where do they sit? So they're also related. If you're using a wearable to measure your steps, it's something that kind of has come from that data from a patient without additional sort of interpretation by somebody else, but it's come from this wearable device. So those sort of wearables and digital health technologies are also included in this sort of framework, I think, of things. But the main definition is really something that is not translated by something else. So it's a fairly direct measure of something that's applicable to that patient in that way.
So, for example, a rating of the physician of some kind of PET scan or something like this, that would be definitely not a COA.
Yeah, something that the patient or sometimes a caregiver who's very direct with the patient reports, yeah. But not exactly your examples. Your results of your scan, your test results that, you know, have been interpreted, although relevant to you as a patient, is not like from your point when you're a patient, your personal patient or subject point of view.
Okay. And then you mentioned, for example, PASI, which is a specific endpoint for psoriasis. But then we also have these very generic questionnaires like EQ5D on SF36, these type of topics. Also in oncology, we have ones that are oncology specific, but not indication specific. Why do we have both? So the generic questionnaires and the indication specific ones?
Yeah, so you first mentioned this more general, like things that might measure quality of life, as you might think of it, as you said, the SF36, the EQ5D. And that might have a very broad question that says today or in the last few days, how would you rate your own quality of life? And that's a very broad question, and it could be answered in lots of different ways. And you can also understand that for any individual, lots of things could influence that going on. The idea of also having more indication or disease-specific questionnaires, and they show that kind of are able to give that detail about what really matters to that disease. So it's useful to have both types in a lot of cases, depending on the questions you're ultimately trying to answer. You might want these broad questionnaires if you're thinking of comparisons more broadly, outside of your disease area. For example, EQ5D is used a lot in the utility and the economic modeling side of work. So it's still taking values from patients about what their quality of life experience with that treatment is. But because it's a questionnaire that can be asked across all sorts of disease areas, it provides a measure that's a lot more comparable if you're looking at comparisons of costings, for example. Whereas the disease-specific ones really matter for that disease. So yeah, for complete evidence, they both are complementary. But if you're looking more detailed or perhaps regulatory approval, you really do want to be looking at that disease. What are those really symptoms that really matter for that disease and for that kind of really clear concept that you're measuring with the questionnaires?
I think it's not just the costing where the generic questionnaires come in. It's also when you have these stories about burden of disease. Yeah. Let's think about a disease that is not very common, I don't know, psoriasis or COPD or something like this, but is much more rare and where maybe the payers don't have direct understanding of what that actually is. Hear about it first time when they get your dossier. Then it's really helpful to give an understanding, okay, how severe is this disease compared with other diseases that are known to the different people, to payers? And therefore, from just understanding these, the overall burden of disease and how much it is reduced is definitely helpful and makes things a little bit more easy to understand for people that don't deal with such patients all the time.
Yeah, certainly. I think in rare diseases as well, I think that, as you almost say, there's a lot of use for potentially a slightly more broader questionnaire rather than it necessarily lots and lots of development of very targeted questionnaires, because it gives you that more different understanding. But every rare disease is very different, so have very different important symptoms and things like that. So that's where that combination of, yes, some general questionnaires can really help, even in the regulatory setting, and if it goes together with those concepts that are really important in that disease area as well.
Can that also help to better understand, for example, clinically relevant changes? So I know, for example, when we think about these overall changes, yeah, patient global impression and severity or change, and you have this 7-point Likert scale things, that is very often used as a kind of generic question. And then you can look into this and basically look at it as an anchor to look into your more specific endpoints to understand what does a 5-point difference, let's say, on a specific scale, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, definitely. And I think even before the sort of meaningfulness of that interpretation point, I think it's worth appreciating that there's quite a lot of development to get to a questionnaire that's even at that point. So you really need to think about what is that conceptual grounding of the questionnaire, first of all, and that most of that might come from qualitative research work, interviews, finding out what is important to patients so that you're really targeting a sort of something that's a meaningful aspect of health, and then you're taking that forward to identify what's a distinct concept that you can be measuring with that questionnaire. So that's a really fundamental part in this sort of developing a fit for purpose, is the terminology, a sort of validated but a fit for purpose questionnaire at the outset. And I think when you've got that kind of initial idea and the concept of your interest, part of that is thinking about how the properties of that, how reliable is it? How valid is it? If you ask it one day and you ask the next day when nothing should have changed, what happens? And things like anchors, measures, other questionnaire that you just mentioned, it can be really useful with that part of the development of the questionnaire, because you can say, oh, I've got something that I know hasn't changed between these time points. What is going on with this new question I want to do? And equally, you can have a global item. So I know patient scores improved on this. What happened with this concept that I'm looking at? So yeah, I think that you can use these global items in all sorts of ways as well. And fundamentally getting those validation, that psychometric side of the analysis first, is really important. And then this clinical meaningful piece, as you say, the next pillar, if you like, of developing that good PRA measure because absolutely you've got to be able to interpret it. Does a change of 3 points, 5 points, 10 points mean something useful to those patients? So yeah, combining it to make sure that you've got a really clear questionnaire first that's robust and validated and then can be used in the right context. Sometimes we might have a questionnaire that's been used in adults, but if you're going to use it in a pediatric population, does it have to be modified to be asking questions, have to be asked in a different way? Sounds like a really basic sort of example, but it's still got to be fit for purpose in that patient population, if you like. I know, for example, in oncology, it's not all the same, right? Yes, you might use a kind of fairly standard questionnaire. ERTC C30 is a sort of generic across all cancers measure, but within disease areas, you might want to be making sure that if in non-small cell, how much changes are we expecting to see? What's meaningful to patients in physical functioning? Is that the same in breast cancer as it is in pancreatic cancer patient populations, for example? So that's why we quite often end up seeing that we want to do some of that additional validation and think about meaningful change really targeted in that population. And that's what the FDA want to see as well. That's what the regulators want to see, because they want to see that really robust data about how these PROs are able to be used and able to be interpreted in that way. So you've got a really solid PRO endpoint at the end that's really based and really grounded in that area that you want to use it in.
So even if you have, let's say, took PRO for your study, and you say it's used, it was accepted by regulators, that doesn't mean your work is done in that regard. You basically need to do more research specifically to show that it's robust, that it's the properties remains the same, and how far you can transfer from other areas. That sounds pretty interesting. If you would have, let's say, a phase two study, would that give you enough data to inform everything for a phase three study, or would you usually need some kind of specific studies for that?
Yeah, ideally using data from a phase two study is brilliant, because you can use that. You use that to see if those ranges of meaningfulness seem to be appropriate in that study population, and you can use that to inform phase threes. I think depending on the disease area or the time of when you're thinking about this or your program design, you know, it might be you don't necessarily have to do this in every study. If there's similarities, if there's quite consistencies, that if you're thinking of really primary endpoints for regulatory, the FDA really do want to see the evidence that's behind them. The FDA do have some PRO instruments that they call that have been through the FDA validation process. One recently is in non-small cell lung cancer. They're called the NSCLC SAQ. It did take a long time to go through this validation process from the FDA. So they don't expect every PRO you use in any one study to have been like, oh yes, I've validated it, so you could just go ahead and use it absolutely everywhere. There's a pragmatism in that. But as you say, yes, I think it does vary with the disease area, the ranking of, you know, if your PRO is being used as part of your primary endpoint, then it really needs to be sure that you can interpret that and it's right for the population you're using it in. But the FDA have also got a lot of guidance on this. The FDA has got this PFDD guidance series with four guidance documents that they started a number of years ago now. Quite a few years ago, because I must have talked to them about them last time. And they've got guidance 1, 2, and 3 are all finalized. So that's really useful. That's a lot of the background. Guidance 4 is probably the most interesting to statisticians, because it is really focused on that more final hurdle, that more endpoint part rather than the development. It's still sitting there as draft. But half of that whole document is about interpretability or the meaningfulness of your PRO scores and the sorts of analysis that they like to see for that. That is definitely a really good go-to document, and really recognize that having these thresholds of meaningfulness, whether that's within a patient for an individual, how much they change, whether that's how much a mean changes over time to be meaningful, or whether between two treatment arms, a mean difference between groups is meaningful. So there's lots of different nuances to that meaningfulness and that interpretation piece. But yeah, being able to provide evidence that support those different aspects is really key and makes sense.
Yeah, because it's also this meaningfulness is, I think, associated with different decisions. Yeah. So let's say you look into an individual change from baseline after, let's say, 2 weeks. Yeah. And it's for a longer term treatment. The decision might just be, do I continue or do I stop? And so I just want to see whether there's any response. And so you want to see whether that is big enough. Then when you have a placebo comparison, yeah, of course, that does this benefit outweigh the side effects? There's another question. And if you have your active comparator, then I would say, is one treatment really better than the other? Or are they pretty much the same? Yeah, would they feel the same for the patient? Which are all very different questions from my point of view. And so the answers should be very different. And also, by the way, I also mixed up here kind of group differences and individual differences, but that probably yet another topic.
Yeah, and it does get a bit complicated when you start laying it on like that. And I think that's why you have to really be clear about where you're going with what your PRO-based endpoint is. So, you know, what is important, what time frame is important. And I know for me, as a statistician, that I can use that nice Esterman framework now, and the variable, to name this, but the variable, it's not just that you want to look at your change or improvement in a score. You need to know what time frame that's relevant in, and that's got to be something that's relevant to the patient in that population and that disease area. So yeah, for me, the Esterman framework there gives you some language to help you with defining that endpoint part. So you might know that your meaningful aspect of health or your concept of interest from the patient interview really early on, you might know that you're wanting to look at fatigue. And then you even might then have done your work and know that fatigue, and we're going to use it with this particular PRO because that's relevant in my really particular patient population. And it's been used extensively. So we've got a lot of evidence that it's psychometrically very sound and validated, if you like. And then that final piece in terms of them, you might then know what that change in score and how to interpret it, but you still need that time point as well, that time frame of interest, to make it all the way to what we would know as a statistician is in terms of those sort of aspects to be able to think about how we then do the best analysis and help with that interpretation.
Yeah. You just mentioned the term that not everybody is used to, psychometrically sound. What does that actually mean? What is psychometrics?
I would have to say that until I started working at Adelphi here, I hadn't really come across this concept either. And what does it mean? Yeah, exactly. What does it mean? But I think it was things I was talking about before, earlier, in terms of to do with those properties of a questionnaire. So not thinking about a treatment effect in the way that a clinical trial statistician might come into this, but thinking about how we take those concepts that are out there that may or may not overlap. How do we ask different questions to come together and make this domain? How do we work out how we should score them? How do we work out that we might ask 10 different questions, but some of them are redundant or they overlap a bit? You only need to ask 5 questions because they mean different things reliably to different people. So we might do, the psychometricians might do things like a sort of factor analysis approach in your data to make sure that you're really getting this right kind of questionnaire. And then you might be thinking about how should that be scored? Should it be a total score across all these things? Should it be an average score? And what are the properties around that, given the concepts that are there? Can you have a total score that adds up lots of really distinct concepts? You're combining physical functioning with something that's a symptom, right? You can't really add them together and get a useful score because no one's going to be able to interpret that, right? But sometimes things are more linked together and you can cluster them and you can say, okay, there are 7 really important disease symptoms here, and then we can make a meaningful total score. Or you can say there are six things and there's another question that's important to patients, and that might be separate. So I view it like that. Everything around that kind of properties of the questionnaire, we sort of term psychometrics aspect. And some of it, as we said, that borderline, how do you interpret it? What's meaningful and how do we assess that? So we might still use statistical techniques, what we might think of to do that, but we're not comparing potentially treatment arms in that way. And when we do a psychometric analysis, say we mentioned before in a phase two data, it's always a blinded analysis. We don't use the treatment that anybody's been assigned to. We're just saying, okay, these patients showed an improvement on this anchor. These ones declined. How do we evaluate meaningfulness? So yeah, that's another way of looking at it. And there's a lot of, I think that's it. It's one of the things to say, really appreciate, there's actually quite a lot of science behind getting to an endpoint that we just see as a 0 to 10 in a clinical trial SAP, right? We're like, oh, great, it's 0 to 10. How tricky is that? But it's really been thought through and it's really comes together. You might get things like the FACT questionnaire and it, how does this end up being scored from 0 to 132? But it's got all these different components, but it's got these components because they're really important on their own to make up this FACT G total score, for example.
So key aspect there is looking, for example, from a statistical point of view in the whole correlation or covariance metrics of all the different items or questions that you're using to better understand how they relate to each other. And the factor analysis or PCA, principal component analysis, would look in more into understanding how these go together. Are there subscores? Are they going actually in the same direction always? Yes, so if the patient improves, do they all improve or do they go in the other direction or don't they change at all? Yeah, as you mentioned, the redundancy. Another aspect is, of course, are they stable over time? If there's no change, then there shouldn't be so much variability because then you might interpret changes being as real when in fact there's not. They need to be somehow stable. If you have something from the physician point of view, and so not the patient itself, but another rater, is that more or less stable across different raters? Is this inter-rater variability is another topic. Are they ceiling effects or flow effects? So there's items always or nearly always the top category or the lowest categories, and they don't carry any variability and therefore no information. So these are all kind of different things that you need to look into. And I find it really fascinating how you come up with these set of questions at the beginning. And also not just the set of questions, but also the anchors that you have within these questions, from never to all the time. And there's so many different anchors. It's really fascinating. And in terms of when you talked about concepts, for me, this is kind of, I want to give an example. I worked a lot in ADHD. And there were usually three concepts, inattentiveness, hyperactivity, and impulsivity. And inattentiveness was largely uncorrelated with the other two, but the other two usually go together because they're highly correlated with each other. And so that's why you have usually a total score, and then you have two subscores. If you want, you can break one even further down, but hardly anybody does that. But this is when we talk about concepts, and one concept is usually represented by various questions or items.
Yep, you're exactly right. Yeah, and I think that's all part of this terminology keyword development, and you really summarized all those sort of steps that go together, and psychometrics is the broader term for those sort of type of quantitative analysis. But we often potentially do sort of mixed methods almost to these where you're using the patient's interviews to say qualitative, what did they see as a meaningful change? Would they, given this score is this many points, what does that mean to them? And that can help go together with what you can see on a kind of quantitative level as well. They're very different. You can get different answers from these approaches, but you can put these, stack them together, and it gives you a really rich picture in terms of what's going on and what's behind that. And sometimes if you've got using it as a primary or secondary endpoint, a COA, It might even be that even though you've got a nice, well-developed COA or PRO instrument, you might also have some qualitative interviews included in your clinical trial to give a little bit more richness, if you like, to the patient experience in that trial, and not just a number of what a mean change happened in 200 patients. You can have these small numbers of interviews that really flesh out what fatigue means to them and what a change means to them in terms of their life and what they're able to do in the morning and have energy and get out. And it might vary for different people and massively varies in a disease area, for example, as well. But one person being able to go for a run, being able to see their grandkids, being able to get out of bed without pain, all sorts of different concepts can come together and not come together, can be measured. And then you can really use those qualitative side to support that more rigorous numerical endpoint and that we see. And we have to see in an evaluation of treatment effect, right? We want to see that in our clinical trial designs and understand that as well.
Okay, very good. Then the last question, which is really important for all our project or trial statisticians. How do I choose the right COAs or PROs for my clinical trial?
And I don't think there's a quick one answer, I'm afraid, but you've got to start with the patients and the clinicians. Most disease areas are some precedent. Really, what is a meaning? What's meaningful? What's really key in aspect of the health? There's the literature. There is what everybody else is out there. You need to find something that's fit for purpose. So as I mentioned before, the sort of concept of validated PRO is not quite strictly true, but yeah, there is a concept. It's got to be fit for purpose. It's got to be reliable to use. It's got to be consistent, provide you with those sort of results. And you do want to have a PRO strategy with regulatory engagement early. You know, this is what we think we're going to measure. This is why, and get that alignment. We mentioned payers as well. We know they like to see that patient sort of endpoint as well. But yeah, regulatory alignment, really clear, and really document all that evidence in terms of where you're going. I think different, if you look in any one disease area, there'll be newer questionnaires that are coming along, some really established ones that everybody uses at all time points. Do I need a new one? What's wrong with the old? I don't think we always need a new one. That's not really the game we're in. We all want to be efficient, and that's perfectly fine. But is it suiting the purpose? And then in terms of thinking more forward, you know, practical implications, we don't want a big burden on patients. The FDA and everybody, I think, if you're running a trial and your regulators, they really don't want us to be asking memes and memes of questions. So there is also that part of, yes, we might want to know about disease-specific symptoms and more general quality of life and adverse events from the patient's viewpoint. So that getting a little bit of a balance between what we want to ask, how often you need to ask it in your clinical trial as well. And so it's thinking again about what's that strategic kind of evidence base that you're going to need to meet, and how can you do that in a sort of robust way that's not burdensome, because that's not great for anybody.
Yeah, I've worked a lot in psychiatry, and yes, of course, it's very questionnaires heavy, and you don't want to have hundreds of items, yeah. Especially not when you deal with, let's say, older patients or pediatric patients. Yeah, the endpoints that you collect at the end of that kind of is probably not that valid anymore, when people are completely exhausted from ticking boxes.
Yeah, and I think that often one of the things that really comes up with PROs is that, you know, handling missing data sometimes is, the biggest concern with PROs. And obviously, the best way is to avoid missing data. So design a schedule of assessments that's going to work. Don't ask too many questions, but are focused on the right things. And statistically, there are things you can do with missing data when you're then looking at a treatment effect. But really, what you want to do is have something that's fit for purpose for collecting what you need, and really to think about not how many questions you ask as well, but also how often you ask it. You know, do you need a daily diary data, really? Or could you ask a question just once every 7 days, and would that give you what you need? Maybe it wouldn't if something's very fluctuates, right? There's definitely a place for some sorts of diaries, data collection. They could be really intense, but equally in other areas, no, you could ask for 7 days. Maybe you ask something every 6 weeks or very occasionally, and it still gives you a long-term input. So really is quite context dependent. And that, yeah, strategic answer to how to choose them. But there's quite a few of those components. And yeah, probably my final one on that is, yeah, really thinking about that interpretability piece. It's got to be relevant with what they need, but where you get to the end, is that going to be interpretable to your different audiences? You might have different opinions from your patients, your clinicians, your regulators, your payers. Always a bit of a juggle about what the best approach is there.
Completely agree. It needs to fit into your overall evidence strategies that you have. And here, it's not just about your clinical trials. It's also how do these fit into the bigger picture. And if you are the only one with this new or different questionnaire and all the others have used another questionnaire, you make your life harder because it's much more difficult for payers, for regulators, for patients to put your data into perspective. I've seen that once where new compound used one anxiety questionnaire and all the others used another anxiety questionnaire. And it's really bad from doing any indirect comparisons or any of these kind of things, because the difference in the questionnaires is bigger than the difference in the treatment effect.
Yeah. There's the other side, isn't there, as well? Like, in sometimes things were developed a long time ago, say, for example, sort of oncology ones, or probably in other disease areas where the treatments have moved on, the concerns of patients have moved on somewhat. It doesn't mean a disease has changed, but maybe we're diagnosing things at different stages. And the questionnaire that was once used is now potentially being used perhaps much earlier and asked about questions that are not relevant. So there is that balance between you can't always just use whatever you used in the past. There's a space for advancing sometimes. So yeah, a bit of a balance there between the two. But yeah, being really clear of what that concept is and why that's important, I think, is really helpful. And it flows through to everything you then do as a statistician at the end in terms of that interpretation.
Thanks so much, Rachel. That was an awesome discussion about all kinds of different things, Eros and also Coas. We touched on where they're coming from, why they have evolved a lot and play now a much more central role than, let's say, 20 years ago. I think it's really the standard things that we are now using, as it was much more controversial 20 years ago. I think for younger statisticians, they may not realize how much of a change we have actually seen. And there's a couple of different reasons why you might want to have both generic and indication-specific questionnaires or COAs. And what a good COA actually looks like and what are strategic thoughts you need to have to include it into your clinical trials. Anything that is really important that you want to see listener to take away from this episode?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, hopefully we've got over in our chat, really. I think it's that appreciation of that development of a PRO score. It's quite a long process and it involves a lot of really good research, whether that's interviews with patients, and also, as we were talking about, the kind of properties, exactly how it's scored. It hasn't just been, oh, really easy. It's really thought out. It really measures something that's meaningful. And from that, you can get to a really good concept and you can get to a really good PRO endpoint. And I think just continuing to be able to analyze those in a rigorous manner and being able to interpret them really well and appreciating there's lots around that. Nuances interpretation are complicated, but it's important to understand a bit of that background, and that'll really help you really interpret it, really make sure that you've got a meaningful endpoint where we can really help use this in these pivotal phase 3 trials to provide evidence around that treatment benefit decision-making process, I think. So yeah, I think I really appreciate a lot more than I did for I worked in this field, that all the work that goes into them and then the things we can really champion as statisticians to we now understand some of that background, some of that why the score is what it is and how we can really use that really advantageously. And patients can be more confident that they've had a direct view and that's really accounted for in all sorts of disease areas that, as you say, maybe didn't used to be as common previously. Yeah, hopefully that.
Thanks so much. Last notice, As we are recording this, we are a couple of months away from the PSI conference in 2026, which will take place in Belfast. Rachel, are you attending?
Yes, I have even booked a ferry over to travel there. So yeah, I've got a poster and my patient reported outcomes SIG. I've got a talk. So yeah, excited to be there and see everybody, catch up with all the statisticians and hear some wonderful talks because, yeah, a big fan, of course, of the PSI conference.
So we'll put a link to the PSI conference, also to the PRO SIG and the documents that Rachel mentioned into the show notes. So you can find all of them there. And maybe if you come to the PSI conference, if you listen to this later than the PSI conference 2026, and you come to the next one in 2027, don't know yet where that is, reach out to Rachel and myself. We'll likely hang around there. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you. Great talking to you. Bye.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who helped with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.